Now entering the truth zone, deep into the vortex of the information revolution with your host, Michael B.
I am your host, Michael B., and this is The Truth Zone, coming to you live an hour later today due to personal issues, and it is so nice to do a 24-hour podcast with no pressure, so that when there is a rare time to deviate from the set time that you're all used to, it doesn't cause too much damage. When I was doing a once-a-week show on Block Talk Radio and really had a live audience and a chat room and roundtable discussions, there was a lot more pressure, obviously, to show up at that Tuesday night at 8 o'clock Central Time without fail. Here, I have a little more flexibility. And I thank all of you that listen to my show. I know there are steady listeners. I can tell, you know. I've got followers on Spreaker. Several of my shows have been downloaded, and I really appreciate that. Please do download them, share them with your friends, put them all over social media. Go for it. My only proprietary right is thetruthzone.com. I paid for that domain. Other than that, please feel free to send it out there. So, what prompted me for today's show is that I had kind of a debate with someone on Twitter, because Dinesh D'Souza called America a democracy, and I've gotten into the habit of automatically and swiftly correcting people that we are a representative republic, and then someone has to come along and chime in and say, well, the term democracy and republic is interchangeable, and pigeonholes a couple of excerpts from Thomas Jefferson. I provide real evidence to the contrary, and he doesn't like it, so he labels it, oh, law notes, fake. Yeah, see, that's the new thing. See, in Donald Trump's exposing the political agendas of quote-unquote news organizations like CNN and calling it fake news, he also opened up a Pandora's box, because I've noticed that be it a self-professed liberal or a self-professed conservative, if they don't like an article or a video that you put up, it has to be fake. And it becomes even more exciting when they use Snopes to back up their claim, run by some fat broad with a cat. So, you know. So it is a Pandora's box. Everything is fake now. Look, it came from Law Notes. And I'm going to read you that article, and here's why. Now, I'm going to warn you today, it's going to be a little more drier. It's going to be a little more educational. I feel it's really important, though, for us to arm ourselves with knowledge. And the knowledge is, of course, are we a republic or are we a democracy? And here's why it's so important. This last election for president personified the issue. The losers who voted for Hillary Clinton demanded that the Electoral College be done away with and Hillary handed the presidency because she won by 3 million votes. All right, first of all, She won by 7 million in California. California is arguably the most politically corrupt state by far in the entire country. It's also been reported anywhere from 3 to 7 million people voted illegally. And I guarantee you, overwhelmingly, over 70% came from California. We see by Jerry Brown's policies, giving illegal aliens licenses, wanting them to vote. It's this don't ask, don't tell situation that they have over there now. Sanctuary cities. And I'll even pigeonhole it even more. It wasn't just California that would have put Hillary over the top and made her president if we were a democracy. If you go inside the state of California, I'll give you two cities that would have done it. Los Angeles, which has Beverly Hills and Hollywood. I don't have to tell you again about that corruption. And San Francisco. If you know anything about San Francisco, they've been, shall I say, weirdos for 100 years now. So it wouldn't have been just a state that would have given you Hillary Clinton. Two cities in particular that are saturated with mental disorder called liberalism. So we are, without a doubt, a republic. I'm going to go into that article. I'm also going to arm you with what type of people were our founding fathers. Now, I showed you that they were devout Christians, and they framed the United States of America according to the teachings of Jesus Christ through the Gospels and the Pauline letters from the Apostle Paul. I showed you that it's indisputable, it's undeniable. The ones that want to say, well, we've evolved, we're not a Christian nation anymore, those guys are archaic and outdated, they're antichrist. Just be assured of that. Just understand that. Because there's only two sides. You're either on the side of the cross or you're against the cross. You are either for Christ or you're antichrist. It's like, I laugh, pro-life or pro-choice? No. The opposite of life is death. You're either pro-life or you're pro-death. Choice is not the opposite of life. So, if you don't want to call yourself pro-death, well then it should be your non-choice versus pro-choice. Those on the non-choice, I'm pregnant, well, I'm a mom, and I'm a dad. There's no choice in that. There's no going back. We did it. And then there's choice. It's inconvenient. I'm really not in the mood. I'm really not ready to be a mother. I'll just get rid of it. You know, like that. So, I'm going to show you why we are a republic. And I'm going to show you the type of people the founding fathers were. I gave you the spiritual aspect. You're now going to get the secular aspect. And this will show you the fundamentals that we, as 21st century Americans, are compelled and really, when you're born here, or when you go through the naturalized process, you basically have taken an oath to defend the United States of America and to live by the Constitution and the original intent thereof of the Founding Fathers. So, this comes from 1215.org/law notes. And as memory serves me, I believe the Magna Carta was written in 1215. I believe that's so. So let's look at this. Here we go. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands. Not the democracy, not the republican democracy, not in the social democracy, but and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, which means we should not be adopting multiculturalism, which is a divider, with liberty and justice, not just for the rich and the privileged and the connected, but justice for all American citizens. In the Pledge of Allegiance, we all pledge allegiance to our republic, not to a democracy. Republic is the proper description of our government, not democracy. The author invites you to join him in raising public awareness regarding that distinction. And we have a duty, ladies and gentlemen, to educate the public, especially our young people. I was in Bible study last night. We're talking about making it more personable and relatable. We have a sworn duty of above all else to educate our young children on the Bible and the Constitution, especially in these times. Now, I know some of you will say, well, that's a cliche. Every time thought it was the time. And I understand that. But as we've progressed through history and with information at our fingertips, there really is no more excuse to be ignorant. You had that in the 50s, the 60s, I mean, really right up to the 90s before the internet. You had one voice, and this was being discussed by Roger Stone on Infowars.com yesterday. The TV was your, and the physical newspaper, and the radio. Those were your three main outlets, but they were all connected. They were all mainstream media. So you got your news and current events from these people. You place trust in them to be honorable, and let's face it, to do research on your own, you'd have to go to the library. You'd have to read books. You'd have to go through microfiche. Kind of time-consuming. But now we're in a position where we have so many alternative and independent media that you type in a few words in Google or whatever search engine you use, and you can now investigate for yourself what the truth is, and you can build on that and share with that. So we are in the times where there are no more excuses. You either have the gumption and the initiative to find out the truth and to share the truth, or you make the decision to just conform and comply and go, yeah, you know, whatever. But then when you get touched directly, don't start crying because you didn't take the step. So, a republic and a democracy are identical in every aspect except one. In a republic, the sovereignty is in each individual person. In a democracy, the sovereignty is in the group. That's absolutely correct. The majority rules over the minority. The Electoral College forces both final candidates to campaign in as many states as they can. If this was a democracy, a straight up and down vote, like every other election that takes place, because they're all in state, which personally, I think there should be many electoral colleges in governor races. That's just my thought. If this was a straight up and down vote, Trump and Clinton would have just campaigned basically in New York, Texas, and California. And I'm probably missing another state that maybe have significant populations. But that's about it. They wouldn't be campaigning in the smaller states. And quite frankly, our voices wouldn't have been heard because it would have been California and New York monopolizing the presidency. So it is incorrect to say that America is a democracy. Now, Here are the definitions. Republic. That form of government in which the powers of sovereignty are vested in the people and are exercised by the people either directly or through representatives chosen by the people to whom those powers are specifically designated. Note, the word people may either be plural or singular. In a republic, the group only has advisory powers. The sovereign individual is free to reject the majority groupthink. USA exception. If 100% of a jury convicts, then the individual loses sovereignty and is subject to groupthink as in a democracy. Now, democracy. That form of government in which the sovereign power resides in and is exercised by the whole body of free citizens directly or indirectly through a system of representation as distinguished from a monarchy, aristocracy, or oligarchy. Note, in a pure democracy, 51% beats 49%. In other words, the minority has no rights. The minority only has those privileges granted by the dictatorship of the majority. The distinction between our republic and a democracy is not an idle one. No, it is great. It has great legal significance. The Constitution guarantees every state a republican form of government. That's Article 4, Section 4. No state may join the United States unless it is a republic. Our republic is one dedicated to liberty and justice for all. Now, I know some of you are rolling your eyes, because I do too. Do we really resemble that republic anymore? Not so much. Those are not minority rights. I'm sorry. There's no such thing as significant minority. There are no minority rights except civil rights, privileges, granted by a condescending majority. Only 5 of the U.S. Constitution's first 10 amendments apply to citizens of the United States. Simply stated, a democracy is a dictatorship of the majority. Socrates was executed by a democracy. Though he harmed no one, the majority found him intolerable. Some dictionary definitions. Government. The government is but an agency of the state, distinguished as it must be in accurate thought from its scheme and machinery of government. In a colloquial sense, the United States or its representatives considered as the prosecutor in criminal action, as in the phrase, the government objects to the witness, Black's Law Dictionary. Government, Republican government, one in which the powers of sovereignty are vested in the people and are exercised by the people, again, either directly or indirectly through representatives. And this is in regards to Duncan, 139 U.S. 449, 11th Circuit Court, 573. Also, Minor versus Happersett, Black's Law Dictionary. Democracy. That form of government in which the sovereign power resides and is exercised by the whole body of free citizens directly or indirectly through a system of representation, again, distinguished by a monarchy. Democratic form of government. Here's an example. An environmental organization proposes a bill for the ballot that every individual should reduce his water household usage by 25%. To assure that this goal is met, the government or private sector will monitor every individual's household water consumption rate. If an individual does not meet the goal, his first offense is $500, second offense, $750, and 30 days community service. Third offense, $1,500 fine and 30 days in prison. And it goes on to other offenses. The people argue this environmental issue back and forth. They argue the pros and cons of the issue. This great debate is held at town hall meetings. Strong opinions are on both sides of the matter. One side preaches, it is for the common good. The other side rebuttals, this is control and not freedom, and loss of choice. Election day occurs. The people go to the ballot box to settle the problem. The majority won by a vote of 51%. the minority of 49% lost. The minority is ignored. The majority celebrates while the minority jeers in disappointment. Since the majority won, the bill goes into effect. As a result of the majority winning, every individual must reduce his water usage by 25%. For the reason that the majority has mandatory powers in a democracy. Those who wish to go against the collective will be punished accordingly. So let's go to the Republican form. An environmental organization proposes a bill for the ballot that every individual reduce the water usage 25%. The government or private sector will monitor everyone's household. And again, the same penalties. The people argue this environmental issue back and forth. They argue the pros and cons. Strong opinions are on both sides of the matter. One side preaches common good. The other side says control and loss of freedom. They have the election. The people go to the ballot box to settle the problem. The majority won by 51%, whereas the minority lost by 49%. The majority celebrates while the minority jeers in disappointment. Since the majority won, the bill goes into effect. As a result of the majority winning, it is advisory that every individual reduces household water usage by 25%. For the reason that the majority has advisory powers in a republic. Bearing in mind that each individual is equally sovereign in a republic, he is free to reject the minority. He may choose to follow the majority and subject himself to the rule, or he may choose to not follow the majority and not subject himself to the rule. The minority has a voice and rights to refuse to accept the majority. Everything is advisory in a republic. It's not a compulsion. This brings liberty and peace to the realm. Notice that in a democracy, the sovereignty is in the whole body of the free citizens. The sovereignty is not divided into smaller units, such as individual citizens. To solve a problem, only the whole body politic is authorized to act. Also, being citizens, individuals have duties and obligations to the government. The government's only obligations to citizens are those legislatively predefined for by its whole body politic. In a republic, the sovereignty resides in the people themselves, whether one or many. In a republic, one may act on his own or through his representatives as he chooses to solve a problem. Further, the people have no obligation to the government. Instead, the government, being hired by the people, is obliged to its owner, the people. The people own government agencies. The government agencies own the citizens. In the United States, we have a three-tiered caste system consisting of people, government agencies, and citizens. The people did ordain and establish this constitution not for themselves but for the United States of America. In delegating powers to the government agencies, the people gave up none of their own. See the preamble of the Constitution. This adoption of this concept is why the U.S. has been called the great experiment in self-government. The people govern themselves while their agents perform tasks listed in the preamble for the benefit of the people. The experiment is to answer the question, can self-governing people coexist and prevail over government agencies that have no authority over the people? Now, I say yes if there is an adaptation and an adherence not just to the government but to the teachings of Christianity, which is the highest level of morals and ethics one could possibly achieve and adhere to. And that is exactly what John Adams said. He said, the U.S. Constitution is only built for a religious people. The citizens of the United States are totally subject to the laws of the United States thanks to the 14th Amendment. Please note, U.S. citizenship did not exist until July 28, 1868. As a matter of fact, the collective states were considered individual and independent countries. Actually, the United States is a mixture of two systems of government, Republican under common law and Democratic under statutory law. And we're seeing, I believe, that through increased government regulations and more laws on the books, we are slowly entering into a democracy, which will then put us into an authoritative state in total if we do not put the brakes on this ourselves. The people enjoy their God-given natural rights in the Republic. In a democracy, the citizens only enjoy government-granted privileges under the guise of civil rights. Anything that the government can give you or take away are not rights. They are privileges at the behest and good graces of the government. If that is not tyranny, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know what is. There was great political division between two major philosophers, and I'm going to get into that in the next article. This is a great segue, Hobbes and Locke. Hobbes was on the side of government. He believed that sovereignty was vested in the state. Locke was on the side of the people. He believed that the fountain of sovereignty was the people of the state. Statists prefer Hobbes. Populists chose Locke. In California, the government code sides with Locke. And that's very ironic, because we know the state that California is in. Sections 11120 and 54950 both say, the people of this state do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies that serve them. You know, Jerry Brown, Governor Jerry Brown, should look into this, because you know what? He's in violation of both constitutions then, isn't he? I believe the entire California state legislature has violated both the federal constitution and its state's constitution, and they should be held accountable. The preambles of the U.S. and California constitutions also affirm the choice of Locke by the people. Now, he writes here, and I'm going to change that. It is my hope that the U.S. will always remain a republic because I value individual freedom. Well, here's the problem. It is my hope. It is the hope of the host of the Truth Zone that the United States of America will be restored to the republic it once was. And it is my belief that the 14th Amendment has to be done away with. And that we must revert back to a collection of individual sovereign countries. And that the government should be by the people, of the people, and for the people, as opposed to a country that and a government that is only for those that can pay for it. Because that's basically who we are now. And of course, we're seeing the depreciation in quality of this country on a spiritual, ideological, and societal way. It's no accident. Thomas Jefferson said that liberty and ignorance cannot coexist. And the footnote is, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. Do we look more civil as a country now or perhaps earlier on? That is a question I leave for you. Will you help to preserve minority rights by fulfilling the promise in the Pledge of Allegiance to support the Republic? Will you help by raising public awareness of the difference between the Republic and a democracy. Well, I surely have taken the challenge. And I urge all of you, teach your children as young as possible. It is easier to teach children and groom healthy adults than to fix broken ones. So let's go into the second article. Who founded the country? And it's going to talk about Hobbes and Locke. So this article goes back 5 years ago. And it was written actually to Rick Santorum, who during the primaries criticized Ron Paul and libertarians. Now, I understand where Rick Santorum is coming from, because today's libertarian is not what the founding fathers were. Today, it is my belief that libertarians are liberals and anarchists. They think that you can exist with no laws at all and no government, which is ridiculous. Government is a necessary evil because, I mean, let's face it. If we're not going to be unified in the cross, and if we're not going to be unified in the U.S. Constitution, then we're going to have our own levels of morals or ethics, and we've really been polluted with situational ethics and unlimited amount of shades of gray. And therefore, we're going to have differences of opinion. I like to use this example. If we have no laws and no government, as a property owner, I may view a stranger coming onto my property uninvited as opposed to my neighbor. A stranger coming onto my property, I may feel compelled to shoot him in the chest. My neighbor may welcome that. Let's say that same neighbor went on, that same stranger went on my neighbor's property. He may ask him or her, "What are you doing here?" See, if there's no common laws, that's anarchy. We could just do what we want. Who can stop us? So I understand. I believe Santorum when he said, one of the criticisms I make, and this is Rick Santorum speaking, to what I refer to as more of a libertarianish right, they have this idea that people should be left alone, be able to do whatever they want to do. Government should keep our taxes down. Well, I do believe that, and keep our regulations low. I believe that too. That we shouldn't get involved in the bedroom. Well, I believe that too, except when, you know, government likes to force certain agendas. But at any rate, we shouldn't get involved in cultural issues. Well, see, now I will disagree with that libertarian, and I agree with Rick Santorum, because when we have certain ideologies coming in to harm our society and that go against the teachings of the founding fathers, then yes, we must address that. So I do agree with that statement. That is not how traditional conservatives view the world, and we'll get into the neocons. There is no such society that I am aware of where we've had radical individualism and that it succeeds as a culture. Now, he's right. He's absolutely right. But see, I believe, again, he's addressing 21st century hardcore libertarians who, to me, are really anarchists. And they're liberals. They're not the constitutional-loving true libertarians of our founding fathers. So, as David Boas pointed out in the interview with Judge Napolitano, Santorum seems to oppose a basic American principle, the right to the pursuit of happiness. I agree with him on this, but there is something even more fundamental here than that. It has to do with the conservative philosophy itself. One of the statements that Santorum makes is true. That is not how traditional conservatives view the world. There is a great disconnect between average Americans who refer to themselves as conservatives and the small groups of politicians and politically connected businessmen who call themselves likewise. The members of the former group believe in the founding principles of the United States, including the inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit, not the guarantee, but the pursuit of happiness. They believe that these rights are endowed by their creator. In other words, they pre-exist the government. They are not created by the government. It is the government's one and only job to protect, not dictate, but to protect those rights, not give or take away, but to protect. And when the government fails to protect them and instead violates them, it is the duty of the people to alter or abolish the government. I don't think it needs to be altered. I don't think it needs to be abolished. I think many people need to be arrested and removed from office. These inalienable rights are also referred to as natural rights, meaning that man possesses them even in the state of nature, state without government. For Jefferson, whose philosophy was inspired by Locke, the reason that men formed governments was to protect these rights better than they could be protected otherwise. Locke viewed man as capable of both good and evil. For Locke, man's natural side was a state of reason, which meant that he respected the rights of other men and observed the natural law of non-aggression. How's our military-industrial complex doing with that? Not too good. The state of nature has a law of nature to govern it, which obliges everyone. And reason, which is that law, teaches all mankind, who will but consult it, that being all equal and independent, no one ought to harm another in his life, health, liberty, or possessions. For Locke and his philosophical heir Jefferson, this natural law of non-aggression was the basis of government power. By prohibiting aggression by one person or group against another, the government would preserve the natural rights to life, liberty, and property. Now, do you see? It wasn't the pursuit of happiness originally. It was life, liberty, and property. Importantly, repelling aggression was also the limit of government power, for when the government exercised power for any other reason, it was committing aggression itself and invading the rights it was meant to protect. That this was Jefferson's guiding political principle is clear from many of his statements to that effect. In his first inaugural address, he argued for a wise and frugal government, which shall restrain man from injuring one another, shall leave them otherwise free to regulate their own pursuits of industry and improvement, and shall not take from the mouth of labor the bread that it has earned, meaning no freaking income tax, thank you. This is the sum of good government, and this is necessary to close the circle of our felicities, and it's basically happiness. In a letter to Francis Walker Gilmer in 1816, he wrote, "Our legislatures are not sufficiently apprised of the rightful limits of their powers, that their true office is to declare and enforce only our natural rights and duties, and to take none of them from us. No man has a natural right to commit aggression on the equal rights of another. And this is all from which the laws ought to restrain him." Obviously, 201 years later, Thomas Jefferson would not be pleased with our legislators. Even on religious freedom, Jefferson based his position on the non-aggression principle. "The legitimate powers of government extend to such acts only as are injurious to others, but it does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no god. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg." Well, I'm going to say this. I'm going to add a caveat. Thomas Jefferson wasn't dealing with Islam then. But by the way, it's interesting because he had to deal with that on the Barbary Coast, the Somalian pirates attacking United States ships. And the imam said to Jefferson, it is his duty to Allah to attack Americans. So Thomas Jefferson did get a little wake-up call in regards to that. So sure, people can have religious faith, but when it starts to encroach on everyday society, that is where the government is to step in and preserve the general welfare of its citizens, not put everyone on welfare. These ideas that I have just expressed to you are not conservative ideas. They are the classical libertarian ideas. While Jefferson, Samuel Adams, and the others who espoused this theory may not have called themselves by that name, the basic tenets of their philosophy were the same. Today, the non-aggression axiom remains the fundamental basis for libertarian theory. Well, theory, yes, but the way today's libertarians are behaving, I don't believe the Founding Fathers would approve either. Just as this non-aggression principle serves as the foundation and limit of government power between individuals within society, it is the foundation and limit of government power with respect to other nations. Here is where the military-industrial complex and Washington, D.C. is in violation of this principle. As all nations exist in a state of nature with each other, the natural law of non-aggression is the only one that governs them. As stated before, the non-aggression principle is the basis for the declaration of war power. The purpose of that power is for Congress to debate whether or not the nation in question has actually committed aggression against the United States. What aggression has the Syrian government performed against the United States of America that Donald Trump has handed it over to his war generals to decide when, how, and where to attack the Syrian government? I submit to you that Donald Trump, in effect, is in violation of the Declaration of War Power. If there has been aggression against the United States, then a state of war exists and military action is justified. If it hasn't, there is no state of war, no declaration, and no military action is justified. The use of military force in the absence of a state of war, previous aggression by another nation, violates the natural law. Now, it is proper for the United States government to declare war on the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. It is absolutely correct. They have taken credit for multiple terrorist attacks on United States soil. They are an army. They are an organized entity. They are no different than the Nazis of Germany. Just because the Nazi movement was contained to one sovereign nation, Germany, ISIS is no different than the Nazis just because they occupy multiple countries, and that a ruler of one particular state or states have openly declared sponsorship of ISIS. It doesn't matter. They are an organized army with named rulers, a flag, a code of ethics, if you want to call it that, with the Quran. They are an organized, established ideology. and it is fair to declare war against them. It is fair to arrest and contain all United States citizens and non-citizens on U.S. soil that puts Sharia law over the United States Constitution. It is reasonable and just to arrest and contain those individuals that have created independent, and they have, independent little Islamabads, creating their own individual Islamic states. It is correct. It is justified. Now, the conservative philosophy rejects all of the ideas that I've stated to you. There were conservatives in the 18th century, just as there are today, and their philosophy hasn't fundamentally changed. The writer that most modern conservatives traced their philosophical ideas to was Edmund Burke. He has this to say about inalienable rights. Government is not made in virtue of natural rights, which may and do exist in total independence of it and exist in much greater clearness and in a much greater degree of abstract perfection. But their abstract perfection is their practical defect. By having a right to everything, they want everything. Government is a contrivance of human wisdom to provide for human wants. Men have a right that these wants should be provided for by this wisdom. Among these wants is to be reckoned the want out of civil society of a sufficient restraint upon their passions. Society requires not only that the passions of individuals should be subjected, but that even in the mass and body, as well as in the individuals, the inclinations of men should frequently be thwarted, their will controlled, and their passions brought into subjection. This can only be done by a power out of themselves and not in the exercise of its function, subject to that will and to those passions which it is its office to bridle and subdue. In this sense, the restraints on men, as well as their liberties, are to be reckoned among their rights. But as the liberties and the restrictions vary with times and circumstances and admit to infinite modifications, they cannot be settled upon abstract rule, and nothing is so foolish as to discuss them upon principle. While modern conservatives like Russell Kirk have pointed to Burke as their philosophical inspiration, one can clearly see that Burke is merely restating ideas from the true father of modern conservatism, Thomas Hobbes. Hobbes asserted that in the state of nature, man has a right to everything, even a right to one another's bodies. Hobbes asserted, as Burke implies here, that man's passions would always overcome his reason, and because of this, the state of nature was a state of war of everyone against everyone. For Hobbes, as for true conservatives today, man has to give up his natural rights upon entering society and accept those privileges to liberty and property that the government grants him. Well, you see, here's the problem. The problem is that, again, the state then can then decide what rights you can have and what you can't have, what property you're allowed to have and not have, and if you're misbehaving, not behaving to their liking, they have the right to take those things away. If that does not sound like tyranny, I don't know what does. For Hobbes, not only did man give up his natural rights upon entering society, but he also had to grant the sovereign absolute and undivided power. This was necessary in order to completely dominate man's natural impulses. Well, this more sounds like absolute power corrupts absolutely. This was necessary in order to completely dominate the impulses, which would always lead him to harm his neighbor if they were not checked. Well, we've got more government regulations. We've got more government controls. Do we really look any less violent? I don't think so. Matter of fact, the more that government regulates society, like in our inner cities, gun control, there's more crime. So Hobbes is incorrect. On foreign policy, Hobbes also viewed all nations as existing in a state of nature. Right. We went over that. Since he viewed the state of nature as equivalent to the state of war, he viewed all nations not under the control of the sovereign as de facto enemies, and the sovereign being, in my estimation, the United Nations. In reading Leviathan, one can also hear George W. Bush's famous remark, "You're either with the terrorists, or you're either with us or with the terrorists." This is why conservatives support the deployment of troops all over the world. Like Hobbes, they believe that we are in constant danger from any nation, that we are not completely dominating with the threat of force. Well, here's the thing. We've gone into countries telling them how to live and how to do it. How have they responded, mostly? Do you think they responded in kind? Or do you think they pushed back? I think you know the answer to that. The reason that conservatism seeks to conserve the status quo is because its adherents do not believe that natural rights are inalienable. Upon entering society, man has to give up his natural rights. So the only rights that man has in society are those that he has been given by government. So in other words, man decides your rights and not our creator. Thus, if you get rid of the past, you get rid of the rights. While the status quo might not be optimal, the conservative believes that to get rid of the status quo means returning to the awful state of nature and necessitates reconstructing man's rights via government all over again. Conservatives are always fearful that rights can be lost and never regained, as opposed to libertarians who believe that rights are inalienable. Now, the conservative tradition in America does not trace back to Thomas Jefferson or the Declaration of Independence. No, it goes back to Alexander Hamilton and the Federalists, who were the conservatives of their day. Hamilton sought to preserve the status quo, which was a central government with absolute power, along with its mercantilist economic system, which was out of Britain, which we wanted to leave that, didn't we? The only change he sought was that the system be run by Americans rather than the British. Well, it's the same thing we're facing now with the health insurance industry, isn't it? The GOP, the conservatives, didn't want it run by the Democrats. No, that was a failure, and I agree. But instead of doing full repeal, which they passed in August of last year, knowing that Obama would veto it, the GOP establishment wants to basically give us Obamacare 2.0 with a little tweak here and a little tweak there, but still have the government tentacles on the health insurance industry. So, the Republicans just don't want it run by Democrats. They want it run by Republicans. Same thing. Hamilton was a Hobbesian on every issue, which is why he clashed. That doesn't sound right. I think this is where Mr. Mullen got it wrong. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. No, you're right. Never mind. I was thinking of Burke. Hamilton was a Hobbesian on every issue, which is why he clashed so stridently with Jefferson, who was with John Locke. Hamilton also believed that the power of the federal government had to be absolute. Otherwise, the separate states would be in the state of nature with each other and inevitably at war. Well, I don't know. Because I believe the only time that the states were at war was the state of 1860, which the government was pushing for more federal power under Abraham Lincoln. And which is why we got the 14th Amendment in 1868, consolidating everyone as U.S. citizens. That's the only time that we've had an internation insurrection. I don't like to call it a civil war because it wasn't civil. Right? No war is civil, and it wasn't fought by civilians. No, it wasn't. It was the Union government versus the rebellion, which was the Confederate Army. And look, the South, for a while, broke off into a separate and distinct Confederate group of independent states. One could argue that the South was actually fighting to preserve the preamble to the United States Constitution, whereas the Union Army was fighting for absolute power. One could make that argument. Economically, he wanted a central bank. High protectionist tariffs to enrich domestic manufacturers at taxpayer expense and internal improvements, which meant the government using taxpayer money to build what we would today call infrastructure. Well, all of these policies were anti-free market. They served the agenda of securing the loyalty of a wealthy elite to the government. Now, one could argue, well, we need an infrastructure. How could we pay for it? Very simply put, the infrastructure of every state should be the responsibility of every state. And this is why you have toll roads and you have service roads. This gives the individual sovereign person a choice. Do I want to go down the toll road and pay the toll, or do I want to take a little longer drive and take the service roads and not pay the toll? That, folks, is liberty and choice. And if every state would take care of its own business, well then, the Union, as it were, will be taken care of through osmosis. I'll say again, if every state took care of its business, the Union of States would be taken care of itself through osmosis. The conservative tradition can be traced throughout American history, from the Federalists to the Whigs to the Republican Party. The Republican Party was born as the party of big government, grand old party, centralized power, and a mercantilist economy. Ironically, all that history remembers of the Republican Party at its birth in the 1850s is its opposition to slavery. Its one libertarian position while ignoring its Hobbesian conservatism on all other matters. However, with slavery abolished, the Republican Party retained the rest of its philosophy through the next century and right up to the present day. One could hear it rehashed in any 2012 Republican presidential primary debate. So, we're hitting 12 o'clock. So, basically, that's the story. We are a republic where the individual owns the sovereignty and liberty, not the group. Also, our country was founded by Christian constitutional libertarians, not today's anarchical libertarian. This is what America, ladies and gentlemen, need to be returned to. It is our sacred duty as men and women of God, and as men and women of the United States Constitution, to be knowledgeable and to share that knowledge with not just our fellow Americans, no, I say to you, but with the world. Only in that way can we ever reach a global individual sovereignty where each and every person counts. My name is Michael B. This is the Truth Zone. See you tomorrow live, 10 a.m. Central Time.